Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
Support for LAist comes from Visual Communications, presenting VC Film Fest, celebrating 40 years of Asian and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander filmmaking, with over 200 films May 1st through 10th. Info at festival.vcmedia.org.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us on this Monday. We endured another weekend of rain and looks like a sunny week ahead, which is nice to enjoy some warmer and clearer weather. Coming up later this hour, we're going to be talking about Orange County landmarks that are no longer with us. I was going through Chris Epting's new book, Lost Landmarks of Orange County, and I saw so many venues I'd completely forgotten about. Music clubs, restaurants that are gone. Remember Belial's with pies that were seemingly two stories tall? All these Orange County places that are no more, but plenty of great memories for those of us that remember them. That'll all be coming up with Chris a little bit later this hour. But we begin, appropriately enough, coming out of a rainy weekend with what kind of a mosquito season we can expect in 2024. You might recall from the segments we did last year on Air Talk, 2023 was a miserable year for mosquitoes and very difficult for the vector control officials to really get a full handle on all the mosquitoes that we had plaguing us throughout Southern California. Joining us to talk about the preparations being made for 2024 and what the prediction is for our mosquito population following two wet years is Suzanne Clue, General Manager for the Greater Los Angeles County Vector Control District. Suzanne, good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Larry. Glad to be here.
So let's talk first of all about last year. It was a challenging year. What was the biggest problem in controlling the population?
Yeah, it was a challenging year. I think our biggest problem in controlling the populations was the rain late into the spring season that we're seeing again this year, as well as that big tropical storm Hillary in August that was not just affecting small areas, communities along the foothills, but pretty much countywide added a lot of water to sources that had dried up. And so we started over sort of mid-season to try to control everything. Our biggest problem, of course, are these invasive Aedes mosquitoes that have been here since 11 or 14, depending which species. And those are the ones that you're talking about are causing us all that trouble with all the biting because they do love biting people.
They're very aggressive. So what are the mosquitoes that used to predominate before the arrival of the Aedes mosquitoes?
Yeah, before then, we mostly had our local Culex mosquitoes, and those are the ones responsible for transmitting West Nile virus currently. So we are concerned about those, but they like biting birds, and so it's a mosquito bird disease. And then occasionally, when they bite a human only 2% of the time, they transmit West Nile virus once the virus amplifies in the mosquitoes. So those we are pretty good at controlling, even though we're not able to prevent all the West Nile virus cases every year. So those what we had, and when we all thought we really didn't have a mosquito problem in Los Angeles.
Yeah, this, by the way, is Mosquito Awareness Week, just preparing us for what's to come this summer. Last year, according to California's Mosquito and Vector Control Association, there were 428 human West Nile virus cases in 34 California counties, 19 human deaths attributed to West Nile virus. Is that pretty much how people get West Nile? It's from the Culex mosquitoes or other sources?
Yeah, so this is it. It's pretty much the only way to get West Nile is being bitten by one of those local Culex mosquitoes. I think we have seen in Los Angeles County recently that we've had fewer West Nile virus cases compared to how many infected mosquitoes we're finding in our testing. And I think some of that can be attributed to the fact that we're suffering from these Aedes mosquito bites, and we're all using repellent a little bit more to protect ourselves from the viciousness of those daytime biters. Well, however, last year, sorry, Larry.
No, finish. I'm so sorry.
No, I was just saying last year we got an additional concern, and this is that now we had two cases of dengue fever transmitted locally here in Los Angeles County by these daytime biting Aedes mosquitoes. And so with people coming back with the disease currently at high numbers from all around the world on their vacations and visiting with family and friends, we really expect this to be a dangerous season for us to see more local transmission of this tropical disease in the county.
We're talking with the general manager for the Greater LA County Vector Control District, Suzanne Clue. We have another expert guest who will be joining us momentarily. If you have questions for them, we're at 866-893-5722. We're trying to get ahead a bit on mosquito season. Typically, it's when we're all bedeviled by them and getting bitten up that we then do our Air Talk segments. So this year, I thought, well, this Mosquito Awareness Week, let's see if we can jump on it a little quicker and be prepared. 866-893-5722, or you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. And I was just going to say that a little bit later, we'll get to some of the preventive measures that we can take to try and keep ourselves from being bitten as much by the Aedes mosquitoes who are so persistent. Aedes, by the way, we're not talking about a decade. It's A-E-D-E-S, Aedes, with a D that we're talking about. The dengue fever that you mentioned, that's spread by Aedes. What are some of the other diseases that those mosquitoes can breed?
So these mosquitoes, because these are diseases that don't include the birds, like we had talked about with West Nile virus, it's just a person to mosquito to person. So they can transmit dengue fever, they can transmit chikungunya, they can transmit Zika. If you remember back in 2016, there was a big Zika outbreak that had a lot of consequences for people acquiring it during pregnancies. So those are the things. Theoretically, yellow fever, we keep a close eye on that. There hasn't been a reported case of even imported yellow fever in California in a very long time. But it's something to be aware now that we have these mosquitoes very frequently here all over the county.
We're talking with Suzanne Clue, who leads the Greater LA County Vector Control District. Also with us from UC San Diego, Professor of Cell and Developmental Biology, Omar Akbari. Professor Akbari, very good to have you back with us on Air Talk. I'm interested in hearing how your research has advanced since the last time you were on the program with controlling the population of Aedes mosquitoes. What approaches seem to be working?
Hi, really great to be here again. So our lab is developing new technologies that are based on genetically modifying the mosquito. So we're engineering mosquitoes that that can be released into the environment and will suppress populations of mosquitoes. And essentially what we're doing is we're using a system called CRISPR to generate sterilized males. And we can release these sterilized males at scale. And these males will go out and find wild females. They'll mate with them, and those females won't produce progeny. So over time, the population will become lower and lower, and eventually you can eliminate and eradicate the species without the use of harmful insecticides.
And to what extent does that approach appear to be working?
So we developed the technology. It was funded through DARPA. And we got this system to work in the laboratory, and we've done cage trials. And at this stage, we actually, we founded a company that's based in San Diego out of La Jolla, and it's called Synvect. And Synvect is actually received funding through Gates Foundation and is working to generate these strains and to get regulatory authorization through EPA and hopefully eventually start doing some experimental trials. So that's kind of where we are at the moment.
You mentioned using CRISPR technology for genetically altering the mosquitoes for sterilizing. What about using radiation for the same purpose?
Yeah, there are other groups that are using radiation. One of the problems with radiation is that when you irradiate the mosquito, you cause DNA damage, and the DNA damage is random. And so what happens is you reduce the fitness of the animal that you release, and they don't perform very well in the environment. So with CRISPR, you can generate precise edits in specific genes instead of mutating the entire genome of the animal. So because you're using CRISPR, you're creating these precise edits, the animal you release is actually really fit and can compete well in the environment for those wild females and mate with them, and then you can get suppression. So our approach is a lot more precise, and that results in higher fitness and better efficacy of the approach.
I'm picturing tiny little medical implements to use the, how is the CRISPR technology actually used?
Yeah, so we genetically modify the mosquito to express the CRISPR component. So we express Cas9, which is the DNA targeting nuclease. And then we have another strain that makes these guide RNAs. The guide RNAs basically direct the Cas9 as to where to cut, what genes to cut. And so you encode these inside of the mosquito. And then essentially what we do in the laboratory is we create a genetic cross between these two strains. And we design the guide RNAs to target genes that are essential for female viability and male fertility. So when you cross these together, the resulting outcome is that all progeny are sterilized males. So it's a really cool genetic system that we've developed, and it works great, actually, almost at 100% efficacy.
We're talking with UC San Diego Professor of Cell and Developmental Biology, Omar Akbari, also with us, Suzanne Clu, General Manager, Greater LA County Vector Control District. Mosquito Awareness Week, and appropriately enough, coming out of another wet weekend, we prepare for what two straight wet years might mean for this summer's mosquito population. We're at 866-893-5722, or you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Professor Akbari, is there EPA approval for releasing the sterilized mosquitoes into the environment?
Not yet. So that's something we're working on. We have applications pending. So hopefully we'll achieve that in the near future. We don't see this as being insurmountable because what we're releasing is essentially a dead end animal. It's a sterilized male. But it's not designed to persist in the environment. So it's a very, very safe technology, much safer than what's being used today, which are the insecticides that basically kill all insects, including honeybees and butterflies and things that we actually need to keep alive in the environment. So I believe this approach is much safer than what's being done currently. And so I don't see that those approvals being insurmountable.
Let me share some listener questions. Alex in Norwalk said, I was diagnosed with West Nile virus back at the end of 2022. We should keep in mind that mosquito seasons are likely influenced by the changing climate. Suzanne Clu, can you speak to how these record-setting warm years, how they're affecting mosquito populations?
Yeah, certainly. I think we are seeing, definitely seeing an effect of the climate change. I think the storm that we talked about earlier last summer was one of the reasons we could see. The season also goes longer, and when we get these large amounts of water late in the season, wetting everything, that really increases our mosquito population overall. The other thing is, the warmer it is, the faster the virus multiplies inside the mosquitoes, the shorter the mosquito has to survive in order to transmit it on. So climate change certainly does make a big difference there. And I agree with the professor that releasing sterilized males will be an approach in the future. I think there's a lot of good approaches out there, and we are not against any one of them. But in order to speed up our success rate, we are thinking about, we're going with radiation at the moment with good success, because we are not facing any of the regulatory hurdles there.
And to what extent do county vector control organizations like yours use insecticides to control the population?
We do use insecticides, you know, but over the years we've really moved a lot towards biologicals. So they are like mosquito hormones that prevent them from maturing, or they are mosquito diseases like Bacillus thuringiensis that are really mostly only affecting mosquitoes. The other thing is, we do control a lot while the mosquitoes are still in the water sources, which are like roadside ditches and things that don't support another a lot of other wildlife and is perfectly safe for bird populations to drink from. So I think we may not want to think about the mosquito control of the early 1900s, where we used a lot of oils and things. So we've come a long way. So even when we do our insecticide approach these days, we're much safer.
Phil in Long Beach wonders, how many years will it take to reduce the Aedes population of mosquitoes using genetically modified males? Professor Akbari?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it just depends on the population density and also the release frequency. So we've done mathematical modeling and have shown that at least in the laboratory, we can actually eliminate the population within a year. And so we can use models to really predict that, how that would behave in the wild. And so it just depends on those factors of how many you release and how frequently you release, what the fitness costs of the animals are that you are releasing, and what the population density is. And so it's really difficult to know all those things until you actually get into the field. But we think, you know, other programs that have relied on sterilized male releases have seen a really, really significant population reductions within even a season. So we expect that, you know, we will have lasting effects. Okay. And effects that can be seen really quickly. So, yeah.
Brad in Glendale asks, is there a repellent for mosquitoes that's natural and doesn't have a strong smell? Suzanne Clue.
Well, there's a host of different repellents available, you know, that you can use. It's best to go consult the CDC website as to the different repellents. However, you know, that being said, I think even though it may be not the most natural, is DEET, D-E-E-T containing repellents are still the most effective at preventing bites. There's just been recently another study that showed how much more effective it is than, say, perkeratin or lemon eucalyptus works, but you have to apply these things a lot more frequently, and they are not quite as good at preventing it. So when you're doing it for a nuisance prevention here around LA County at the moment, I think some of the more natural products are definitely a good choice. However, if you were to go to an area that has current dengue transmission for vacation and you want to really protect yourself, it would still be good to use the most effective material containing DEET, and it's been proven to be safe for the last 50 or so years. So if applied correctly, you should not bring any harm to yourself.
Just some other tips, and certainly Suzanne can elaborate, but in addition to repellents such as those containing DEET, you can, this is pretty obvious, dress in long sleeves and pants, especially at dawn and dusk when mosquitoes spreading West Nile are more active, screening doors and windows, eliminate standing water, which Suzanne talked about earlier, even in places you might not think about it, like pet dishes and things like that. Repair your outdoor leaking faucets and broken sprinklers because that can create standing water. Rain gutters with leaves can be a place for breeding as well, and obviously neglected swimming pools, fountains, things like that. We're almost out of time, but Suzanne, anything just briefly to add to those efforts to control the population?
Yeah, no, so be assured that we are out controlling everywhere that we have public access. We're also available for service requests within our service area. That's free of charge. You're already paying for us with your property taxes. So do give us a call and we can come out and help you look through your yard. However, it is really important that when we get these spells of wet weekends or wet weeks and then the warmth that makes the mosquitoes grow fast, that everybody go out into their backyard and eliminate as much standing water as possible so we can work together on trying to keep these mosquito populations low.
Thank you both for joining us very much. That's Suzanne Clue, General Manager, Greater LA County Vector Control District, joining us for the start of the Mosquito Awareness Week here in California. And our thanks to UC San Diego Professor of Cell and Developmental Biology, Omar Akbari. It's Air Talk on LA. 89.3. We're just a few minutes away from talking with Chris Epting, author of Lost Landmarks of Orange County, and I want to hear from you. If there's a place that you really loved, Like for me, the White House in Laguna Beach, which had jazz artists that would come and perform when I was in college. I saw the electrifying Eddie Harris at the White House. And I'll never forget it. Just places like that that are part of our memory, the music clubs. Did you know Billy Barty had a skating rink in Fullerton? I had no idea. The actor, little person, so well known, television and film roles. Yeah, he did. Fullerton. We'll hear about some of the other lost places of Orange County coming up in just a few minutes. Back in 1 minute.
Support comes from Visual Communications, presenting VC Film Fest, celebrating 40 years showcasing Asian and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander filmmaking, featuring over 200 works ranging from narrative film, documentary films, photo exhibits, and new media. VC Film Fest honors our beloved elder cultural workers, linking them to present and emerging artists to empower communities and challenge perspectives. May 1st through 10th in Little Tokyo and in Long Beach. Info at festival.vcmedia.org.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. We're checking in on the future of motion pictures in movie theaters. You know, for how long are theaters going to be able to sustain the comparative lack of content? There just have not been the range of films that there were released into theatrical exhibition pre-pandemic. With us to talk about what exhibitors were saying at CinemaCon in Las Vegas over the past several days is the Ankler columnist Richard Rushfield, who was there in Vegas. Richard, good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So how much of the concern really centers around the change in releasing patterns of the studios?
Well, yeah, that's the big grumble. They showed a lot of movies and a lot of things look great, a lot of potential hits in there, but there were just fewer of them than the theaters are used to. We sort of have an infrastructure that's built for about 120 major releases a year, and we're something under 100 looking at that. So that's a big shortfall. And current releases are what the trailers you see at when you go to a movie now or what you are used to get people excited for the next one. So it's just a sense that the whole ecosystem is being damaged by a light number output.
And is this largely a result of the two Hollywood strikes, which for 6 months meant there was no production, or is this part of a longer term of many fewer films going into theatrical?
Well, the strikes are what it's blamed on, but when you look at the individual studios, there's been a lot of turmoil in terms of ownership and leadership at those studios, a lot of conflicting priorities, a lot of fear of taking chances on new things. And I think that combined with a strike has led to people really dropping the ball on producing new movies and being a little sort of scared of their shadow when it comes to movie releases.
It seemed with the Barbenheimer phenomenon last year that was something that got people who were content to stream for the most part back into theaters in a way that the latest Marvel movie wouldn't necessarily with some of that older demographic that used to be big moviegoers. Are there thoughts that there are films arriving this year that for that particular audience are going to get them out into theaters?
Well, Barbenheimer ended up being so big that ended up being everybody. So it really encompassed them. But the Barbenheimer phenomenon was invoked constantly there about we need more Barbenheimers. The thing was that was really just lightning in a bottle. Like it was just like saying we need to get a huge viral hit every single day of the week, and it, just two things came together and it just caught the internet tailwinds and worked out well. But that's not something you can count on happening every day.
How much are large screen formats like IMAX helping to counteract some of the loss in numbers, sheer numbers of people, because I know they can often charge more for those theaters. Is that helping much?
Yeah, it helps. And more old theaters are being replaced with sort of premium theaters that are more expensive and have upgrade, but it's still when you're off say 20-30% in a year, that's a lot to make up. And I don't the premium seats can only carry a little bit of that weight.
We're talking with Richard Rushfield, columnist for The Ankler, who's back within the past few days from CinemaCon, which brings together movie exhibitors in Las Vegas. Every year they meet to look at the sizzle reels of upcoming films and have visits from the stars of those movies to try and promote the major studio product that's coming into theaters for the rest of 2024. But a lot of angst in the industry about not just, you know, what kind of tentpole films they're going to get, but the kinds of movies that used to be their bread and butter. And it seems like, Richard, the longer term trend here is for many of those just sort of, smaller budget films that we're not seeing those much in theaters unless they're going on the art house circuit. But we're not typically seeing those movies at an AMC or Regal or something like that. Has the die been fully cast on that, or are there a way to get maybe The Holdovers is a good example of that kind of a film that seemed to have developed an audience even in the chains?
Yeah, it's much harder. It was for films like The Holdovers when you had a much more vital set of art house theaters. It gave them a real platform to launch in and take off. And then some of them could sort of cross over. You look at a movie like Poor Things, that which mm-hmm. made $100 million last year, that became a very mainstream success in the end. But that's a rare example. You have one or two of those a year. And not having that art house circuit as sort of a platform and a place where people automatically come back, and having them to fight and them having to fight for screens at the AMC or Regal, which don't necessarily keep them out longer, is not ideal for these films that really depend on a long stay mm-hmm. and word of mouth to get going.
Richard, just final comment on what you thought was particularly notable about the several days in Vegas.
My favorite trend this year was 80-plus-year-old directors returning to their great hits. There are two of them in particular that were Ridley Scott doing coming back with Gladiator 2, and George Miller with a new Mad Max movie, which, as it happened, were the two most exciting-looking movies of the entire convention. So don't discount them.
It's amazing. You could put together a festival of 80-plus-year-old directors, and there's enough out there that are still making movies. It's remarkable. Richard, thank you for joining us. So good to have you with us again on Air Talk.
My pleasure.
Richard Rushfield, columnist for The Ankler, with whom we partner on our Entertainment Thursdays here on LAist 89.3. Just want to let you know that the State of the City address by Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass will be at 5:30 this afternoon. We'll carry it live for you right here on LAist 89.3. That's Mayor Bass's State of the City speech today at 5:30 live on LAist 89.3. Coming up, the lost landmarks of Orange County. I want to hear from you. Do you have a particular one that you really miss? Maybe it's the Mesa Theater in Costa Mesa. Maybe it's one of the great music venues of Huntington Beach. Maybe it's an amusement park that no longer exists. 866-893-5722. It's our Southern California History Monday. We'll be back with Chris Epting, the author of Lost Landmarks of Orange County, in just 90 seconds.
Support comes from Visual Communications, presenting VC Film Fest, celebrating 40 years showcasing Asian and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander filmmaking, featuring over 200 works ranging from narrative film, documentary films, photo exhibits, and new media. VC Film Fest honors our beloved elder cultural workers, linking them to present and emerging artists to empower communities and challenge perspectives. May 1st through 10th in Little Tokyo and in Long Beach. Info at festival.vcmedia.org.
Wonderful to have you with us on Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Hope your Monday's off to a great start. Monday means our Southern California history segment. I look forward to these so much. And it's particularly great when we've got a brand new book devoted to Southern California history. That's the case. Our guest is the author of Lost Landmarks of Orange County, Attractions, Restaurants, Theaters, Music Venues, and Theme Parks. Very appropriately, we've got right on the cover Lion Country Safari in Irvine. That's something I went through a couple times as a kid. You drive your car through this faux reserve with lions and elephants and other wildlife in this supposedly secure environment, although there was a hippopotamus, I recall, it got out, and some other animals. Chris Epting is the author of the book. Chris is a member of the Orange County Historical Commission, or has served on that commission. He's a travel writer and co-created and co-hosts the PBS SoCal TV series, The OC History Hunters. Chris, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, Larry. Pleasure to be
really
here.
Really appreciate it. So we're at 866-893-5722. How long have you been working on this?
That book actually took about 3 years, longer
than
usual.
I'm not surprised.
Because there was a lot to it, as you mentioned, a few of the places, including Lion Country Safari, which today, by the way, if you remember the famous lion, Frasier, the sensuous lion who sired 35 cubs. If you go there today to the location, the park is gone, obviously, it's been developed, but the tree where he is buried under still sits there with a marker describing the history of the park. So you can find in the book, I kind of lay out where there are remnants and things that do take you back to what used to be there.
There are drive-in theaters like the Highway 39 Drive-In in Westminster, and great photos. Where did you find this one of the Westminster Drive-In? There's like nothing immediately around it. It's a dirt road.
You know, there are some great sources, including the OC Archives. Chris Jepson is a great archivist there who was very helpful. And yeah, things like drive-ins. You know, Orange County had a lot of open space back then, and so it allowed for things like Lion Country, for other parks like the Japanese Deer Park, the Buffalo Ranch. I mean, it really was this haven. You know, once Disneyland opened in the mid-50s, that attracted a lot of other people. When you would have a day or two off after Disneyland, you could go see the California Alligator Farm or the Movieland Wax Museum, you know, things like that. So Orange County really became this tourist mecca, you know, with the advent of Knott's Berry Farm and Disneyland.
I saw so many movies at the Mesa because down the street from the college I went to, that was the closest movie theater, the Orange Drive-In, where the Reverend Robert Schuller began preaching from the roof of the snack bar before establishing the Crystal Cathedral many years later. The Surf Theater in Huntington Beach.
Classic Surf Theater. We're actually, they brought the film Casablanca down in the 1940s as sort of one of the first test audiences. And of course, then after that, a lot of famous surf films were premiered at the Surf Theater.
Martin in Irvine says, the movie theater on the peninsula in Newport Beach, does the guest recall the name? The Balboa Theater.
The Balboa Theater.
Which for when I was in college, for years ran Deep Throat. The X-ray, it seemed, because by then there was no real market for that theater for mainstream films. It ran that movie, it seemed like, for 5 years straight
something. Oh, how funny. And the Lido Theater, which is still there, actually, in the same general area that is all also very famous, but not
that's
in the
a great
movie,
theater.
But still there.
Yeah, but they tore down the Balboa.
Yeah, unfortunately.
866-893-5722. Punk rock had a real home in Orange County in the 80s, and there were so many venues. Was it the Doll Hut,
which is still there. You had Safari Sam's in Huntington Beach, which today is the Surf Museum. That's where Jane's Addiction played their very first show in 1985. But yeah, there's a whole subchapter in the book about the punk movement in Orange County because it was homegrown. Unlike a lot of places where kids would come from other areas, the OC scene was sort of based on surf and skate and backyard parties. So I wanted to really, you know, honor that, and I'm a fan of the music as well. So yeah, there are a lot of sites in there about where those bands used to play, including bigger venues like the Golden Bear in Huntington Beach, which really was the premier spot for a lot of big bands.
And the Golden Bears seem to be booked with big acts all the time. I mean, really, their ability to attract those acts for what wasn't that big a club was
300
impressive.
Seats. You had Janis Joplin, Linda Ronstadt, Steve Martin. I mean, band after Ramones, Patti Smith.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it really was a haven. And again, it was that stopping point between San Diego and L.A. I think that's what made it. And it was a great location, right? By the beach, by the pier. The owners always had great food, you know. So it was artists. I talked to artists today who, you know, recall it very fondly.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. Going back even further, the Rendezvous Ballroom in Newport Beach, which Stan Kenton's orchestra played there, all kinds of people.
Big bands, jazz. But then you also had the birth, essentially, of surf music there with Dick Dale. And a fire, unfortunately, took that place down. There is a marker there today. And again, I want to, when people take a book like this, I think it's important to let them know what's there today, what to look out for. You know, are there little, is there a tree that remains? Is there a brick wall that remains? I think it's important to try and help people recreate those things if they go visit.
So true. Rob, in the Mid-Wilshire District of Los Angeles, what Orange County landmark that's gone do you want to bring up?
Just like you, Lion African Safari. Imagine San Diego Zoo being run by Ringling Brothers. And the trick, my dad took me there twice, and I tell you, it made the jungle ride in Disneyland look pretty tame. And I swear, as a little kid looking out the window of the car, that ranger looked like he had a gun on the side of his hip. But it was this feeding time, throwing the meat out on the side of the road. And as we were going along in our Ford Fairlane, this cheetah or leopard, whatever, it looked big to me, with spots, jumps on the roof of the hood of our car and then looks around and then jumps off the hood of the car because you weren't going to get between him and dinner and apparently wanted to eat first.
My memory too, Rob and Chris, was that you had to sign up, you had to accept when you came in any damage that came to your vehicle because tires were sometimes bitten, which is an expensive problem, or paint ends up getting scraped. Or if, you know, even if there was an unfortunate incident, human versus animal, you essentially, not that it would hold up in court, but had to agree that you were assuming risk. I don't know if they ever had any claims that were made about that, Chris, but
they had to have. I mean, look, you look at it today, it's a lawyer's, you know, dream today to think about what that was like. And you mentioned earlier when Bubbles the hippopotamus escaped for 2 weeks and they finally found her.
In the creek down along Laguna Canyon Road,
exactly,
as I recall.
Exactly, but they shot her with tranquilizer guns, but sadly she had a bad reaction and it ended up killing her. But yeah, Lion Country was, they even made a film about Frasier the Sensuous Lion in the early 70s. So,
that's so funny.
So it just, it affected so many people. And then interestingly as well, the music venue, the Irvine Meadows Amphitheater, was part of that property as well. So you had a lot of history right there, and that's gone now too. And again, the site of, you know, hundreds of notable shows over the years.
Remember Orange County International Raceway?
That's in the book as well. I've got a whole chapter about raceways.
My uncle raced there, actually. Yeah.
There were a number of tracks. Huntington Beach had one. You had a lot
Lions
of motocross.
You know.
But the OC Speedway was famous. They say you could hear those sounds all throughout the county.
My grandparents moved to Irvine, and so the sound came right down the canyon.
Yeah.
You'd be in their backyard, and it was like a dragster was going down their little residential street. It carried that far.
And again, it gets to that open space idea of what Orange County was like back in the day, 50s, 60s, 70s. You had room for these things that LA didn't really have at that time. So it did provide this incredible counterpoint, just, you know, half hour away from LA. You could experience these things that really were special and unique for tourists and locals alike.
Susan in Seal Beach emailed, "I loved attending many musicals at the Theater in the Round, Melodyland in Anaheim as a child, right across the street from Disneyland."
Great one.
"And in my early 20s, Susan says, I saw the amazing Chambers Brothers perform there."
Melodyland, thank you for bringing that up, because Melodyland had a beautiful look from the outside, really a gorgeous building, and a lot of religious festivals there, but a lot of music as well.
It became a church later.
Yeah, Jefferson Airplane played there, The Doors played there. I mean, it really, again, another one of those venues that just captivated a lot of people. And we forget about the music history in Orange County. Led Zeppelin played their second show in the United States at UC Irvine in 1969.
When Irvine had barely opened
at that point.
Exactly.
It was brand new at that point.
And there was hardly anything around the campus in 69. We're talking with Chris Hepting, by the way. He's author of Lost Landmarks of Orange County. I welcome your comments. You can add them on our AirTalk page, las.com/airtalk. You can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your first name and your location, or you can call us at 866-893-5722 as we remember these lost landmarks of Orange County. Stephen Pasadena says, I recall seeing Janice and Big Brother at the Lighthouse in 67. Great memory. The Lighthouse in Hermosa Beach. Mm-hmm. It's still open, the Lighthouse Cafe, though it doesn't have the nightly jazz like it did. Keith in Irvine says, I missed the Marine Corps golf course at the old El Toro base. Was open to the public. Great character. Thanks for the Orange County topic. You bet, Keith. One thing is really important. Remember, there were all these military bases in Orange County, mm-hmm. where Orange Coast College is, my alma mater, Vanguard University. This is all old Marine Corps land that was given or provided very low cost to nonprofits to construct colleges. And Orange Costa Mesa Civic Center is mm-hmm. on that property. The Orange County Fairgrounds exactly. are on that property. And then, of course, the El Toro base where the Great Park is and many homes have been constructed. There was so much open space that was controlled by the military, Chris.
I have a whole chapter on military in Orange County, including when the Bolsa Chica Gun Club was taken over by the Army during World War II. People don't even realize there's a site in the book in Garden Grove, which was a prisoner of war camp during World War II, where 1,100 German soldiers were held, and they worked the citrus groves. That was their
That's
how they worked. And some evidently came back after they fell so in love with Orange County.
Even as prisoners of war?
As prisoners, they came back after the war and settled in Orange County after being held prisoner there.
Oh my goodness. Well, there was the German community in Anaheim, so
there you go.
Yeah.
And again, you had there were some Nike missile bases. I mean, again, I wanted to be very careful with every chapter to really unpack things for people, whether it's, you know, dairies or agriculture or military, to really let them know what used to be in the county.
Yeah, and of course, just mile after mile of orange groves. I'll never forget, you know, taking Culver Drive, essentially between Irvine to the Santa Ana 5 freeway. Mm-hmm. It was just lined with orange grove. Yeah. All that mileage, which of course is all developed now. It's
no
hard
more,
to
yeah,
imagine.
No more commercial orchards really left. Although I did learn that in La Habra, there was a place, there was a mail carrier in the 1920s named Rudolph Haas, who planted a thing which became the Haas avocado tree.
Really?
And I went and found where the tree used to stand. There's a plaque there today marking the birth of the Haas avocado.
Wow. And of course, the boysenberry, that has Orange County roots.
Absolutely. Walter Knott fuses a longanberry and a blackberry, and thus, you know, now again,
and the guy's name was Boysen. That's
exactly
how we get boysenberry.
Exactly. And again, Knott's Berry Farm in Disneyland, they've got chapters in the book because they've had a lot of lost landmarks over the years, things, attractions that you may have gone to as a kid that mm-hmm. are no longer there. I wanted to also document that because as those parks evolve, that's interesting to me as well.
It is very much. Oh, Sungha in Brentwood, good to have you with us. What is it that a landmark of Orange County that's lost you want to bring up?
Well, first of all, it's Osunga, and thank you for having me on. I wanted to share about Josh Slocum's in Orange County.
Good restaurant.
It was owned by the restaurant, that's correct. Although I never actually went there as a restaurant, for me it was more of a nighttime, uh-huh. you know,
I used to see Dennis Rodman there.
That's exactly the point. Dennis Rodman was always there. He was always a gracious host, and it was a very special atmosphere.
That's a good landmark. Again, the restaurants, they play an important part in this kind of story as well. You mentioned a couple. You mentioned
Belial's
before.
Yeah, with their famous pies and ice cream.
Exactly. There was the Reuben E. Lee, the paddle boat that sat
right
in Newport Harbor.
Isle.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so there was a La Palma chicken pie shop. So I wanted to capture those as well because food obviously plays a big part in our lives. And a lot of these places we have deep emotional connections to when it comes to food.
I'll never forget the Reuben E. Lee because I ate there close to the end of the Reuben E. Lee. And the first cell phone that I had. I was driving out of the Reuben E. Lee Park. I was coming on to PCH, Coast Highway, and my phone flew out of my window and was lying in the right lane of Coast Highway.
Oh, my goodness.
And so I quickly pulled, you know, and this is the time when, well, they're expensive now, too, but, you know, they were brand new then. And I had to stop this woman from driving over my phone and grab it. That's so the Reuben E. Lee is indelibly in my mind from that post-lunch experience.
Oh, how fun. And you mentioned the White House that you went to.
Yeah, Laguna Beach, yeah.
And Laguna Beach had a lot of other places as well. There was a place called Frankenstein's there back in the 60s,
yeah.
Cafe Frankenstein.
Which was like a kind of beat hangout sort of. Yeah.
Yeah, there was this, you know, Laguna always, I mean, culturally, obviously, was a great artistic haven. And so there's a whole subchapter in the book about that. Again, so much. If you're driving down the Montage Resort, at one time was a trailer park back in the 50s where Lucy and Desi.
They have the palm trees there.
Right, the two palm trees named after Lucy and Desi, which you see in the film. There's a plaque there. So again, the trailer park is gone, obviously. It's a beautiful resort now. But the fact that they kept those trees, I think, is a wonderful kind of throwback.
It is, and it's a spectacular property,
oh, my
the Montage.
Yeah, one of the most beautiful.
It's, you know, it's very expensive, but even if you can splurge for a drink, if not dinner, it's quite. And the grounds are open to the public.
They are.
Spectacular and views off the bluff there.
And it was a trailer park. You know, it's like all these.
Yeah.
And there are other trailer parks I've got in there as well, because back then municipal beach camping was a thing in Orange County. For a couple of bucks, you could spend the night and pull right up and just park on the beach.
You ever wonder where the name Jamboree for that long, wide street in Newport Beach comes from? The Boy Scout Jamboree. He's got an entry for that because this brought Boy Scouts from around the world for this huge camping experience there when it was all open land. We're going to continue our conversation. I'm way late to the break because I'm having so much fun with Chris Epting. Lost Landmarks of Orange County is his book. Attractions, restaurants, theaters, music venues, theme parks. I want to hear from you. Your favorites. I have more from listeners. Listeners to share, 866-893-5722. Back in a minute. We don't want to forget, there's so many Orange County landmarks that are still there, like Crystal Cove, all the cottages being restored, and the restaurants, and even the shake stand at the top of the bluff there. I mean, there are many wonderful historic attractions, parts of Orange County that exist. We're talking about the lost ones, though. Lost Landmarks of Orange County, Chris Epting joining us. He's been on the board of the Orange County Historical Association and loves all things Orange County history. If you'd like to weigh in on this, we're at 866-893-5722. Terry in La Crescenta emailed the Galaxy Roller Rink. Thank you for that. I don't know if that was an Orange County venue. Chris, do you know the Galaxy?
Well, you know, I've got other roller rinks. You mentioned the
Billy Barty's one.
Originally. I'm not sure about that one, but the Barty one was kind of famous and or infamous in the 1980s in Fullerton. Music venue and a roller rink. Metallica played there, a very early version of Metallica. And also there were bowling alleys, Kona Lanes, sort of tiki themed things. I wanted to put all of those in there as well. Because again, Orange County, I think in large part because of Disneyland, you had these sort of, you know, that gave way to a lot of tiki structures and things like that that were inspired by Disneyland. And some of those places are still there today.
There was a Galaxy roller rink. I quickly looked it up. It was in Fullerton, also known as Mr. Bufu's.
Oh, there you go. That same place. Okay.
So was that the same as Barty's? It changed names later?
No, Barty's was separate.
Both were in Fullerton,
I know what she's talking about. Yeah. And roller rinks were popular back then. There's a couple of them in the book. And ice skating rinks and things like that.
Yeah.
And some great theaters that are no longer around.
866-893-5722. Jan in Long Beach also wants to shout out the Golden Bear, Huntington Beach on PCH, really small, so many big names. Yeah.
The best.
It was an incredible venue.
And the famous muralist Weiland, one of his very first murals, adorned the side of the Golden Bear. He used to hang out there. They paid him a couple of bucks and he painted artists that played at the Golden
Bear.
Now
they're around the world.
Yes.
Laguna Beach, Hawaii, multiple
everywhere.
locations. Elizabeth in Montrose said, when I was a kid, my dad took my brother and me through Lion Country Safari in a taxi cab. We were visiting from Northern California at the time, so didn't have a car. We primarily came for Disneyland, but he thought we should have that experience, a wonderful memory. I'm shocked a taxi driver would take his or her vehicle through Lion Country Safari. It was another time,
you know, right by Lion Country, if you're driving in Newport on MacArthur, there's a giant buffalo statue by Bonita Canyon. That marks the entrance of what was called the Buffalo Ranch back in the mid-50s.
Oh, wow.
It was open for a few years. When it shut down, though, those buffalo were shipped out to Catalina Island, where their relatives live today with the original bison that were brought out there in the 20s.
I remember when Bonita Canyon was just open, land shortcut from Irvine to Newport Beach, and it was just wide open. And so were the buffalo in that area?
They were right there, and that's why the street is called Bison right off of MacArthur. That's an homage to the Buffalo Park that used to be there.
Wow. Pam in Newport Beach, good to have you with us. Pam, we're tight on time, but please share with us your favorite lost OC landmark.
This goes back many years ago, could be as many as 30, 40 years ago, but there was a stand-up comedy shop called The Laugh Stop on North Bristol, and that may have been Costa Mesa or Newport Beach, but when I used to go there, a lot of the SNL people would stop by just to kind of hone their craft, and I saw Robin Williams, I saw Gilda Radner, I saw Jim Belushi. I mean, the list goes on and on.
That's
amazing. And of course, at the time, I didn't realize who these people would eventually become, but lots of great memories
But
there.
She brings up a good point, because Orange County did allow you that sort of little to perform quietly outside the spotlight. And Robin Williams played the Golden Bear as well. You know,
have a short drive home.
Exactly.
Before all the traffic we have today. Pam, thank you so much. I love the photo of Hungry Joe's, which was also in Huntington Beach on Coast Highway.
A favorite of Bonnie Raitt's. She told me she loved playing at Hungry Joe's.
It's surrounded by a dirt lot and an oil well next door. And it says on the side, Hungry Joe's, cheap drinks, lousy food.
One of the best slogans in the business ever.
Captures the vibe so perfectly. Ricky in Anaheim. A large orange peel attached to a big drive-thru off the 5 freeway. I believe it was destroyed over 20 years ago. I don't recall that. Mary Beth in Laguna Woods. The Laguna Hills Mall. It was the original mall when I moved here 40 years ago, now completely gone.
Yeah, one of the first malls around there. You know, I want to bring up very quickly one of the worst ideas in Orange County history was Ski Villa over in Carbon Canyon. It was open for a year in the mid-60s. They literally concreted a giant hill, put 2 million interlocking white tiles there that you would ski down.
Oh, my gosh.
But enough broken legs and broken backs shut it down in a year. But it's in the book because, hey, it happened. It's there, and it's a lost landmark.
And Orange County was a place you could take even a nutty idea and try it out. Chris, thank you so much.
Larry, a pleasure. Really enjoying it.
Lost Landmarks of Orange County. Our guest, Chris Epting, the author of the book. Much more to come in the second hour of Air Talk. I sure hope you enjoy these Southern California history segments.
Support comes from Visual Communications, presenting VC Film Fest, celebrating 40 years showcasing Asian and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander filmmaking, featuring over 200 works ranging from narrative film, documentary films, photo exhibits, and new media. VC Film Fest honors our beloved elder cultural workers, linking them to present and emerging artists to empower communities and challenge perspectives. May 1st through 10th in Little Tokyo and in Long Beach. Info at festival.vcmedia.org.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us on this Monday morning. Man, that was fun talking about Orange County landmarks. Every Monday, we bring you Southern California history. I don't know what's planned for next week, but it'll be fun and a surprise, I'm sure. This hour, we begin with Google announcing last Friday that starting today, it would, for some users of Google, start removing the search result links to California news site. This because of a bill under consideration in the California legislature, which would require Google to pay publishers in exchange for the content being linked to in Google search. Joining us to talk about the implications is Jeremy B. White, reporter who covers California politics for Politico. Jeremy, good to have you with us again.
Always a pleasure.
Let's start first with what this bill is. What would it do?
This bill would essentially say that some of these major platforms like Google and Meta that host links to articles would have to pay the original publishers, that is to say, people like newspapers, for hosting this content. The larger critique is that part of why the journalism industry has seen such precipitous declines in recent years is that these websites have taken a big bite out of their advertising and other sources of revenue.
And so Google made this announcement that it's going to be removing these links to search results to California publications for some users. I wasn't sure what that meant. What do they mean, just a random group of users, or have we gotten any details on that?
It's a great question. This is something similar that we have seen, for example, in Canada, when that country was debating a similar bill, where Google will essentially make it so a subset of users, which is to say not every Californian in this case, will not see links to local news when they try to access it through Google. So it's not a permanent or a blanket blocking of this content. It's more a glimpse of what Google argues will happen in the future.
So
now
this,
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, this is a shot across the bow, so to speak.
It's a shot across the bow, there's no doubt. I do think it bears noting that in Canada, ultimately, that law passed. Google began to negotiate with the Canadian government over the structure and exemptions in the law and did not permanently block news as they suggested they might. Meta has maintained that blackout, though. And so you have seen the companies that would be affected by these laws employ a similar tactic to challenge them, but it hasn't necessarily played out in the same way when that has passed.
Then, Jeremy, does this mean you would still see, because LAist, our digital entity, would be part of this as well. So, does it mean that, for example, you might see a search result for Jeremy B. White being on AirTalk, but there wouldn't be a link to the LAist page where the episode resides?
I don't want to get too deep into the details here out of concern of misstating it, but I think the point is that they want to make the argument directly to Californians, who presumably then could maybe make the point to their elected representatives, that look, this is a way that people get a lot of information, and that a law restricting it could stifle that flow of information.
Jeremy B. White, reporter covering California politics for Politico, who joins us frequently on the program. Also with us, general counsel for the California News Publishers Association, which supports what's called the California Journalism Preservation Act, this bill in Sacramento. Brittany Barsotti, thank you so much, Ms. Barsotti, for joining us. Share with us the view of the News Publishers Association and why you think this kind of financial compensation is important.
Good morning, Larry. And I just want to start off by saying, we can look at the history of the rise of Google and the decline of journalism, news, digital advertising and advertising costs. And it's really important to note 80% of the digital advertising revenue is essentially controlled by Google. They own the entire ad ecosystem from the top down. So even when you do click through to our users' content, the ads you see, Google still takes a piece of. I also want to note nothing in the bill requires displaying of links. So the bill is based on whether the platforms are accessing, crawling, indexing, and also displaying information from our publishers' websites.
So does that mean, I'm just trying to figure out what that means in practice. Does that mean if someone searches for information on something, that articles produced in California would still show up, just not a link to that article?
Well, it's really unclear what Google intends here with this quote-unquote test. I mean, I think it is clear that they are planning to censor the critical information that Californians need. to be aware of what's going on. I mean, we've seen this tactic, as Jeremy mentioned, in Australia, the day vaccine registration opened up during COVID, during Canada with their wildfires were going on. And so now at a time where we're coming up on a critical election for the future of our democracy, they are again choosing to cut off the free flow of information that's vital to our democracy.
We're talking with Brittany Barsotti, who's general counsel for the California News Publishers Association. Also with us is Catherine Trendacosta, who's director of policy and advocacy for the nonprofit Electronic Frontier Foundation. Ms. Trendacosta, thank you for being with us. What are your concerns about this proposed bill?
Thanks for having me. So our concerns are partially what has happened, right? Which is that the same First Amendment rights that allow you to decide who is on your program, that allow publishers to decide what goes into their publications, allow Google to make decisions about what they want to display. And if bills like this exist, they will often decide that what they want to do is just not display news. I would further add that our concerns about this bill are that by affixing a value to help to links and to information, you've essentially put a price on news that incentivizes Google and Facebook and other big tech companies to make deals with the ones that with the companies that are the most linked to, which incentivizes clickbait, rather than making deals with local publishers who maybe do local news, which by its very nature is less interesting to the vast majority of people who don't live in those places. So it becomes not a way to help news, but a way of enriching the conglomerates that bought news for pennies on the dollar after Google and Facebook decimated their prices.
We're talking with Catherine Trendacosta, Director of Policy and Advocacy for EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We're at 866-893-5722. Zan in Santa Monica, good to have you with us. You're on Air Talk.
Yes, thank you, Larry. So I'm a publicist, and on Friday when this, what amounts to censorship, happened, I had to search certain articles, and I was not able to find them. I don't think Google realizes the negative ripple effects this is going to have on people's work and livelihood. I did a workaround. I was able to finally get the LA Times and Santa Monica Mirror News. Actually, I could not find Santa Monica Mirror. I did find LA Times, but I'm extremely concerned that most people are not going to go to the extra effort that I went to. I would just add that Matt Pierce, who's the president of the LA Times Union, I don't work for them, but he has described this in a Substack as ghastly censorship and Google's tremendous the profit they're making quarterly. I agree, it's outrageous.
We're talking with listeners Anne in Santa Monica. Catherine Trendacosta of EFF, you want to respond to that?
Sure. I will say, whether or not it's censorship is a question. It is emotionally really tough, and I don't personally believe that this is what Google and Facebook should be doing. They have the right to do it under the First Amendment, and that's why bills like this incentivize all the wrong behavior by these companies.
I just wanted to disclose in terms of LAist, we're part of a group called Lion, the local independent online news publishers, which is opposed to this proposition. We take part in the Radio TV Digital News Association. Some members of our newsroom have to be members of the organization in order to enter for awards like the Murrow Awards. We as an organization have not taken a position on the legislation. And we would not do any lobbying on this from our news operation. So I just want to fully disclose that we do not take a position on this. Sam, thank you for your call, 866-893-5722. Let me just read. This is for, a Google blog posting from Jaffer Zaidi, which reads in part, this California Journalism Preservation Act would create a link tax requiring Google to pay for simply connecting Californians to news articles. We've long said this is the wrong approach to supporting journalism. If passed, the CJPA may result in significant changes to the services we can offer Californians and the traffic we can provide to California publishers. By helping people find news stories, we help publishers of all sizes grow their audiences at no cost to them. CJPA would upend that model. It would favor media conglomerates and hedge funds who've been lobbying for this bill and could use funds from the CJPA to continue to buy up local California newspapers, strip them of journalists, and create more ghost papers that operate with a skeleton crew to produce only low-cost and often low-quality content. CJPA would also put small publishers at a disadvantage and limit consumers' access to a diverse local media ecosystem. That's just the first two paragraphs of what's a much longer blog post from Jaffer Zaidi on behalf of Google in that blog post, just laying out the opposition to it. And it closes, looking ahead, we'll continue our efforts to work with lawmakers on alternative paths that will allow us to continue linking to news and supporting the news ecosystem in California. Brittany Barsotti of the California News Publishers Association, your response to the claim that this advantages big publishers who are in the business of acquiring and stripping local publications of their journalistic talent.
So that's just simply not true. We've worked very hard on this bill to come up with language that ensures a set aside for small publications. We're also making two critical amendments, which are important to pay out per journalist and help steer the funds towards California. Our bill requires 70% of funds go to journalism jobs. It's important that these publications do have access to these funds so that they can continue to employ journalists. The information that Google takes and scrapes and then displays, they're not paying for right now. And without journalists, news quality will continue to go down. And I also want to make sure I respond to the charge of clickbait. Google has complete control behind the curtain. Nobody knows how they prioritize, how they search, what their algorithms do, and they are the keepers of the internet. So if they wanted to perhaps disincentivize clickbait and promote more quality news, they have the option to do that. They also have the option, of, as we've seen, to completely shut off the flow of important information. And these types of bullying tactics are just designed to silence journalists, intimidate newsrooms and legislatures. And another important piece, so we saw this in Canada where they went to a per journalist payout, and that actually disproportionately benefits the smaller publications because it's less expensive to live in more rural places and to be able to $20,000 per journalist like they're doing in Canada would benefit someone who lives in, let's say, Elk Grove, like
who,
I do.
Who determines who's a journalist? What are the criteria? Because you've got, you know, so many people call themselves journalists. What's the filter?
Well, there's a pretty long definition that I don't want to bore folks with on what is an eligible digital journalism provider, but the classifications of types of jobs that are journalism jobs include drafting content, editing, display, publishing, all kinds of editorial roles, pretty much most of the typical roles you will see in a newsroom. Part of the photography as well. So part of the reason it's a bit of a broader definition is because we have so many small publications out there. And for our small members, they're wearing multiple hats.
But yeah, let me just, I'm sorry, we're limited on time. Let me just, so further clarify, if someone is operating a publication that calls for violent overthrow of the United States and they have editors and people who write for them, think, would they be eligible for compensation?
I believe they are excluded under the definition of eligible digital journalism provider. There are examples that are federal statutes, forgive me for not having the numbers right in front of me, that would address that. But again, Google has the entire power on whether or not they want to display that type of information to users.
But I'm talking about the compensation, because wouldn't this money go into a pool to compensate, or would it just be based on the hit-by-hit payment to that entity?
Well, the hit-by-hit payment you're talking about right now is something that's going to be changed in the bill. So it's going to be a per-journalist payout. It's not going to be based on impressions. And based on the definition of eligible digital journalism provider, an entity that is advocating for the overthrow of the government would be excluded.
We're talking with Brittany Barsotti, General Counsel for the California News Publishers Association, Catherine Trendacostas, Director of Policy and Advocacy for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Brittany is in favor of the legislation that's been dubbed the California Journalism Preservation Act. Catherine is in opposition to it, and talking with us generally about this bill and Google's response to it is Jeremy B. White, who covers politics, reporter for Politico. If you have questions, we're at 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. But we're actually out of time on this, so we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to thank all of our guests. We're going to be talking about one of the most difficult questions to be asked when you're on an airplane, and why it can set people off in some of the ugliest ways. We'll get to that when we come back in just 1 minute.
Support comes from Visual Communications, presenting VC Film Fest, celebrating 40 years showcasing Asian and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander filmmaking, featuring over 200 works ranging from narrative film, documentary films, photo exhibits, and new media. VC Film Fest honors our beloved elder cultural workers, linking them to present and emerging artists to empower communities and challenge perspectives. May 1st through 10th in Little Tokyo and in Long Beach. Info at festival.vcmedia.org.
I saw this piece a few days ago in the Wall Street Journal, which was just fascinating to read. The four most divisive words on a flight. Will you swap seats? Don Gilbertson wrote the piece, which laid out some of the intense conflicts that can occur over that question. Apparently, there are some people who feel absolutely entitled to be upset with you if you refuse to trade seats with them, even if, you know, you have the ticket to sit in the seat that you're in. The reasons for the ask can be as basic as somehow you and the person you were traveling with ended up far apart on the plane, and they feel the need that they need to be together to talk about something important or to provide comfort. If maybe one of them's not a comfortable flyer and found themselves seated apart. But there are a number of other reasons people ask, and to talk about those is Laura Ketterman, who's flight attendant for one of the big three airlines and co-host of the airline employee and aviation podcast Non-Rev Lounge. Laura, so good to have you back with us on Air Talk.
Thank you again, Larry.
I appreciate it. So what are the range of questions that you hear with passengers behind them wanting to switch seats?
Most of the time is they do want to sit next to someone that they're flying with, or they want to sit with their children. And a lot of people are buying the basic economy seats, and those come without a seat assignment unless you pay extra, and then you can purchase your seat assignment. Basic economy seats get assigned at the airport about 1 hour prior to departure. So a lot of times they are not seated together.
But wouldn't, if you have people that are traveling in the same party and bought the tickets at the same time, they don't get their seat assignment together as a pair or a group?
Well, if they're basic economy and they show up 1 hour prior, if there are seats available together, the computer will certainly assign those together. But a lot of times, you know, people will purchase the window seat or the aisle, and that leaves an awful lot of middles.
So I my question for listeners is, so how do you feel about that? If someone, if you've paid extra, let's say, to be able to choose your seat and not have it randomly assigned, and you have half of a couple that asks you, hey, would you mind trading your seat so I can sit next to my loved one on the flight, when they didn't pay for the ability to reserve seats? How do you feel about that? We're at 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722. If you've had someone get upset with you because you didn't want to switch seats with them, how did you deal with that? If you've made a request, what were the reasons why you requested it, and how was your request received? 866-893-5722, or you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Laura, what are the airline policies on this? Do the flight attendants just stay out of it?
Well, usually we are asked to be part of that, because they'll ask if after someone says no, they'll come and get a flight attendant to see if we can mediate the issue. I also have tools as a flight attendant. I have my tablet, that my work tablet, which shows me empty seats, so I can kind of move some people around. You paid for that aisle. I've got another aisle up here that mm-hmm. will get those two people together. Also, we charge for food and alcohol. I can entice with free food. Our drinks are $10 each. $10 each. That's a great enticement to get people to move.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I think there are probably a lot of us that don't mind if it's a like for like seat, but, I wouldn't want to move to a middle seat even to reunite a couple for a flight if I'm paying extra, which now you typically do, to avoid a middle seat. So I wonder, I would feel fine about saying, no, I'm sorry. I'm not going to move a middle seat so you can have my aisle seat or whatever. But, if it's a like for like, if there's no negative for me, I'd be happy to move in that circumstance. Is there consistency with how passengers respond to this?
There really is not. It sure depends on whether the flight is absolutely 100% full or not. And quite frankly, since COVID, our flights are 100% full.
Yeah.
But usually I can entice people if it's is for a small child or something like that, because I don't want to sit next to someone's small child and do their coloring book and give them. But
my wife would. You know, she'd take that on gladly. But go ahead.
But you know, if you really have that much of a fear and you have to sit with your loved one, then you know, I'm sorry, but you probably should have paid for a ticket.
Yeah.
Paid for a seat.
Yeah, if it's important to you, and I know it's expensive. Air travel is expensive now, so it's an extra cost because everything, of course, is an add-on at this point. But it sounds like, at least in some cases, based on Don's article in the Wall Street Journal, there are some people who are trying to save money by, you know, just taking the assigned seating, but then trying to sort of hustle their way to get a better seat by getting someone to give up theirs. We're at 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722. You can email us with your experiences with changing seats at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Let's talk with Christopher in Burbank. Christopher, what do you think about being asked to switch seats on an airplane?
I agree that there's a time and a place to do it. Like if there was a parent with a younger teenage child or an elderly couple that didn't get together, absolutely move a seat. But if someone is just trying to take advantage of buying a seat at a cheaper price than what I paid, absolutely not. I even ride Amtrak, and Amtrak, we can pay for our seating to know where we're going to sit. There's a price to convenience, and I'm sorry, if you're going to take the low ball, then you're going to get what you're going to get. So,
Christopher, thank you very much. 866-893-5722. Michael in Alhambra, your thoughts about people asking to switch seats from what they've been assigned or purchased?
Absolutely not. And the reason I say so is because for the past 20 years, if I'm not able to purchase a window seat online, 90% of the time, if I ask at the ticketing counter, and if that doesn't work, option number two is when I ask at the gate, I'm able to get a window seat, like 90% of the time. So I don't. So the people have two options, and I don't understand why they haven't tried that. And I've been able to get a window seat for like the past 20 years.
Michael,
so,
yeah.
No, these people. Go ahead.
I appreciate it very much. I wonder if in many cases, though, the folks who aren't paying extra also showing up, you know, kind of last minute for the flight, maybe aren't getting there early like you are to negotiate that at the gate.
I try anytime if I don't get there early. But, yeah, I guess they're just assuming people will be nice.
Yeah.
And I like my, like everybody else for the most part. I like that window seat, and if they didn't take the time to try in advance to do that, sorry.
All right. Relying on the kindness of strangers. Michael, thank you very much. Lisa in Burbank emailed, airlines often make passengers pay extra for choosing their seats, often charging more to sit on the aisle. I wouldn't move from an aisle seat, especially if I paid extra. I firmly believe I'm entitled to sit in the seat I paid for, and I wouldn't move. And Lisa, I agree with you bottom line. I mean, I think if you feel particularly generous and you want to, move to help someone out, great. But I think bottom line is it should not be expected. You're doing a kindness to someone if you agree to switch your seat, in my view. Laura, I'm curious your thought. I mean, ultimately, the person who pays for a specific seat, they are entitled to keep it, right, for whatever reason.
Oh, absolutely. And when I was listening to Lisa's comment, I was thinking to myself, amen, sister.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, some people like we have Bill in Santa Ana says, I'm happy to give up my seat if it's a parent and child. If I had to, I'd go to the back of the plane by the restrooms. It just seems like the right thing to do. I don't care what inconvenience it is to me. Bill, bless you. That's a very thoughtful thing that you would do. I think for a lot of other people, and I don't think it's a moral failing on their part, wouldn't necessarily feel that way. Sharon in Sherman Oaks says, I wouldn't do it because I have a bad back and long legs. I usually pay extra. Unless it's moving up to another seat that's the same kind as mine, I won't do it. That's Sharon in Sherman Oaks. Allison in West LA says, I've flown several times where I book seats with my family and the airline has canceled our flight. That means when our reservation is rebooked, we're no longer together and the only way is to ask people to swap. Allison, I hadn't thought of that. Laura, I assume that happens a fair amount of the time.
That does. And we have wonderful gate agents that work very hard at trying to get those families together. They will actually make announcements out in the gate area to try to move people around to like seats so they can get the families together. But sometimes, the flight is full.
Let's talk with Sue in Torrance. Sue, it sounds like you had a particularly unpleasant experience around this.
Yeah, I sure did. It was pretty awful and scary, actually. I was on a work trip from Los Angeles to Arizona, so it was about an hour, and I was in the window seat, and the gentleman in between was on his honeymoon, and his fiance was on the other side of the plane. Apparently, the person sitting next to him said no, and so he had the flight attendant ask me. I was utilizing that hour to finish up some work stuff, and I really needed that space, so I declined. He got upset and literally started pushing on my seat and being aggressive.
Wow.
I had to report him to that same flight attendant. And then later he actually followed me in the airport, called me racist names. And one of the people in the airplane actually told me to be careful and to report him to security in the airport.
Sue,
and
what a terrible.
Even his fiance was holding him back. It was only an hour, and it was pretty scary.
Sue, what a terrible experience. And for an hour, I mean, it wouldn't be excusable if it was a 12-hour flight. But that makes it even more bizarre. But what a terrible experience for you. Laura, have you had something like what happened to Sue happen to any of your passengers?
Well, we have had instances like that. And we do say, if you're ever threatened or you feel that aggressive behavior, please tell your flight attendant, because we are trained to handle those kind of situations. And we would have moved you, if we could, to somewhere where you would be more feel more safe, even if it was just an hour. Another thing is, after he asked you and you said no, if we'd known about it, we would have said maybe I would have said something like, well, let's get you a honeymoon cocktail and we'll get a honeymoon cocktail for your bride. And it's 1 hour. Let's celebrate with that 1 hour cocktail. And then you guys will be on your honeymoon. That's how I would have handled it.
Sue, do you think he was under the influence? Could you tell?
Not at all. And, you know, unfortunately, I don't think that I got the help I deserved until it turned into an escalated situation where I literally had to put my hands up and scream stop. I had already told the flight attendant, and it took about my third time before they actually moved him.
Sue, that's just a terrible, I mean, even talking about it now, I assume bringing it up again is unpleasant. And thank you for sharing it, but that's just a terrible outcome. Sue in Torrance.
It's unacceptable, really.
Yeah.
It's unacceptable.
Wow. Michelle in Costa Mesa emailed, though I look healthy and typical, I have vertigo. And if I don't sit by a window, I'll vomit. That's the reason I pay extra for a seat and not switch it. But when I flew Southwest with my 8-year-old daughter and we ran from gate to gate, hardly catching our second flight, I was really disappointed that on an assignment-free flight, no one was willing to move in order to seat her next to me. The option was for her and I both to sit between two men rows apart. Finally, someone moved for us. That's Michelle in Costa Mesa. 866-893-5722. Ajit in Irvine, you have a way of resolving the conflict. What is that way?
I do. Thanks, Larry. You have a great program.
Thank you.
I used to be a very frequent traveler. There are two kinds of seat poachers. Those that sit in the seat and then ask you, can you switch seats? And those that ask you after you've taken your seat, can I switch seats? Now, the one exception, I don't like to switch seats, but the one exception I make is I see a parent traveling with a child, infant, lap child, whatever, I'll be happy. I automatically give my seat up to them so that they can have a little bit more room and I find some space elsewhere on the plane. To handle the seat poachers, my solution is this. Carry, if you're going to be a seat poacher, carry about... five Benjis in your pocket, because if you meet me and you ask me, Ajit, can you switch seats? I'll say, absolutely, gladly. Give me $500 in cash and we're good. Thank you. Here's the seat.
Puts an end
so
to
I
it.
Think,
yeah.
That's the way to handle this. And I haven't quite used this in public, but it's been festering in my mind. So that's the way I would handle it. So
all right. Ajit.
My advice is carry a few $100 yeah. in cash. And
if you want to buy someone's seat. Okay, Irvine's Ajit joining us on Air Talk. Julie in Studio City, how do you handle the request to give up your seat?
Yes, my solution, I always give up my seat for families with children as well. But my solution is, there's absolutely zero reason an airline should be charging you to pick your seat.
Oh.
There's no reason. We could solve this issue. We could settle everybody down that's flying. Nobody's going to get followed into the airport or seats kicked. We can just pick our seats without having to pay.
Well, but Julie, I'm sure from the airline's perspective, they say there's a value on this, therefore they can monetize it, and there's not been enough of a rebellion on the part of flyers to that. People have pretty much just swallowed hard and accepted that. So, but Laura, you know, what do the airlines say about, you know, they nickel and dime us on so many things like this, but charging for a seat assignment?
I agree that they do try to monetize everything they can, from baggage to drinks to food. But it is just the way it is now, unfortunately. I agree, but then you're going to charge higher price for everything else. And people really like to have the ability to pay the basic economy. And then there's people who like the ability to pay for the first class.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of people and all kinds of ways to pay.
Dorit in West Adams emailed us, "Only one time I agreed to switch seats to allow a dad to be next to his teenage kids. Well, the kids then refused to switch. They didn't want to be on a flight next to their dad. And shortly into the flight, I understood why the kids felt that way." Oh, Dorit, that's hilarious. We have more comments and calls about the middle seat. So we're going to take a brief break. We'll continue our conversation, take a few more listener comments and calls on what you do if you're asked to switch seats, or if you're someone who has asked to switch seats. We've heard from people in that circumstance as well. How did those conversations go? We're talking with Laura Ketterman, flight attendant for one of the big three airlines and co-host of the Airline Employee and Aviation podcast, Non-Rev Lounge. We'll be back in just 90 seconds. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. This has certainly struck a nerve. I didn't realize how much it would over being asked to switch seats on an airline. I'm sure our guest, who is an air travel professional, isn't surprised by that because she deals with it daily. Laura Ketterman, flight attendant for one of the big three and co-host of the Airline Employee and Aviation podcast, Non-Rev Lounge. Laura, I assume you're not surprised to hear all these stories.
No, it's quite the hot topic.
David in Altadena says, "I was once asked to give up my seat so a couple could sit together with their developmentally challenged young son. I agreed to give up my aisle seat and sat in the row in front." Scroll is moving here. "Between two dudes of size, I'm 5'7". One of the guys would nod off every minute and slump over and bump me, so there was no way I was going to be able to sleep on a 3-hour leg of the flight. The couple with their son sitting behind me noticed what I was enduring and offered to buy me a drink. I needed more than just one at that point. I vowed never to give up my seat again." That was David in Altadena. It is nice they offered you a drink, though. David in Hawthorne emailed, "Awaiting departure on a flight from LAX to Tokyo, a guy asked me to swap seats so he could sit with his wife. I did. Then the gate agent came and asked, 'Are you Mr. So-and-so?' I told her we had swapped, and after she conferred with him, she came back and asked if I would like to move upstairs. I got to take advantage of his first class upgrade." Wow, David, your kindness was certainly rewarded. Lisa in Burbank says, "I would not move from an aisle seat, especially if I paid extra. I believe I'm entitled to the seat that I chose." Oh, I think I shared Lisa's before. Let's see. We have Michelle in Costa Mesa. I think I shared hers as well. Okay, let me share some others. Michael in the City of Commerce says, "I fly with my family. The flights are so booked. Sometimes there are only middle seats left, so there isn't the option to book seats together." I guess one of the things I don't understand is why, particularly if you're talking about a fairly short flight, why people feel that they need to sit together with, you know, the person that they're going to be traveling with and spending hours or days with anyway. I do understand if there's an anxious flyer or both people are anxious flyers. I understand if it's a child. But if you're talking about two adults and neither of them has acrophobia, I just wonder, you know, what the reason for that would be. Laura, what's your thoughts on why it's so important for people to sit with others in their party?
I think it might be just the excitement of the travel journey that they're on. They want to start their vacation or whatever together. It's going to be hard to gets some sympathy from the flight attendants. When we travel space available, and we're always sitting in those middle seats. I, as a flight attendant, I try to get everyone together, but it's going to be hard to get that sympathy from me when you can purchase a ticket.
Well, plus you sit on those little jump seats too, when you're working, right?
So, and there's No padding on that.
Yeah, those look very uncomfortable. I can't imagine, particularly with turbulence, having to deal with those little seats. Liz in Southgate says, I got the TSA fast pass, so I'm always at the gate early. And as soon as I get to my seat, I pass out and fall asleep. So no one really asked me to switch seats. That solves the problem for me. Laura, do you recommend that for someone who just doesn't want to be asked, at least pretend you're asleep in your seat?
Pretend you're sleeping. You know, I've seen people put on masks too, like they're sick. So people are like, ooh, yeah. Ooh, I don't want to sit next to that person because they're sick.
A performative cough, anything like that.
Yes.
All right. 866-893-5722. Bill in Santa Ana asks an interesting question. More work for the airlines here, but I think he has a good thought. What about when you purchase your ticket, a box could be provided that says potentially willing to switch seats to allow parents and children to sit together? That way, Bill says, the airline people assigning seats would know who is willing. It would be much more efficient. Laura, is that feasible?
Oh, I think that may be feasible. Sure. And we could, on my work tablet, everybody has a different color depending on their status at the airline. And they could put a little special color on that so I would know that they are willing.
For those of us with no special status, what color do we get?
You get blue.
I'm a blue. Okay. No, don't give me any extra consideration. 866.
And that's a blue blood.
Very good. Well, thank you. I'll take it that way. 866-893-5722. Tiffany in Palms emailed, I've been flying with my kids for 20 years back east several times a year. I started buying seats to be together, even buying my kids seats and keeping mine basic economy to save money. We now always go early because if we don't, we'll get on the plane. People are already in our seats, causing quite an argument. I paid. It's my seat. Wow. Laura, what do you do if someone has camped out in another person's seat?
Well, we do ask for them to show us their boarding pass, and I can look on my tablet and know who actually has that seat. And I'll say, oh, I show that John Smith has that seat. Let's see what seat you have. Why don't you come with me in the back alley?
All right. We're going to take a break. We'll continue our conversation with Laura Ketterman, flight attendant for one of the big three, co-host of the Airline Employee and Aviation Podcast, Non-Rev Lounge. If we have a moment, we'll ask her as well about some of the other sources of conflict aboard flights. Since we have her expertise and experience, we'll take advantage of it and be back in just 1 minute on Air Talk.
Support for LAist comes from the LA Times Festival of Books, back April 20th and 21st on the USC campus, featuring hundreds of events with authors and celebrities. General admission open to all. You can learn more and reserve a spot at latimes.com/festivalofbooks.
Edison International, committed to supporting cleaner air and stronger communities by investing in education and the environment. Learn how they're working to create a clean energy future for everyone at edison.com/community.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. We're talking about conflict aboard air flights and some of the challenges that flight attendants have in dealing with this, and particularly when people are asking about moving seats. Rich in Canoga Park emailed, I suspect most flyers don't realize even seats in the same section cost wildly different amounts. Many passengers think a plane is like a flying bus and can't understand why others wouldn't just switch. Rich, that's a really interesting point. Laura Ketterman, is that the case that there are flyers that don't understand the value, what people have paid for particular seats?
Absolutely. You get some people that know that have fly all the time, and then you get the other people that are once a year travelers.
All right. Jill in Pasadena, you're on Air Talk.
I just wanted to share my solution for the middle seat. Usually my husband and I, we buy or reserve the middle seat and the aisle seat. I'm sorry, the window seat and the aisle seat on the hopes that nobody will purchase the middle seat. And then if nobody is there, we have more room. And if somebody does have the middle seat, we will always offer to switch so we can sit together and one of us will take the middle seat.
And I'm sure the middle seat person's all too quick to take you up on that offer.
Yes. Yeah, they're thrilled.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a nice trade. You know, I wonder, though, Jill, if that is still as effective when almost all flights, it seems, at least the ones I've been on lately, are so full that it seems almost certain that that middle seat is going to be purchased. Let me ask Laura about that. I mean, do you get many open middle seats anymore?
Well, first of all, kudos to you, Jill. And we do get a few people that purchase their seats that way. And that's an excellent way. If you've got the extra income, you can do that. That's a wonderful thing to do. But I do see that quite a bit, people doing that. And they are happy to pop, the middle person is happy to pop into that aisle or window.
Yeah. But I just wonder how many middle seats are even. So in you know, with more recent purchases with Jill and her husband, I just wonder whether they, you know, end up with that empty. Well, I guess even if they do, they just say they switch. So that resolves it. Jill, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Ray in Riverside says, one time I had a ticket for a specific aisle seat. Someone came on the plane who had a ticket for the exact same seat. How does that happen? And what do you do? Wow, Ray. Laura, have you ever had that happen, that a seat is sold twice?
Well, shoot. Yeah, we've had that happen, even though it's all computerized. So sometimes someone will buy their ticket and then get their seat assignment, and then they will print their boarding pass at home. They get to the airport. Meanwhile, things happen with the airline. We can go from one certain type of aircraft to a different, and that will change everybody's seat assignments. Sometimes that happens. Sometimes, you know, they reboot the system and that'll change a seat assignment. It's very rare that it happens today with everything computerized. But when that happens, I look at my tablet. I see what I can do, what I can offer. But we had hoped that would be caught at the gate with the computerized check-in.
Yeah, it makes sense. Laura, what are some of the other biggest sources of confrontation on flights?
Oh, I've got to tell you, it's got to be the overhead bin space.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
Yeah, you know, I purchased this seat in row 12. I should be able to put my bag above.
Oh, so people assume that it's guaranteed to be able to have their bag close to them.
Correct.
Yeah, it's interesting because obviously they're not marked and there is no such guarantee, but people just assume that convenience.
Yes, yes. And nowadays our bins are much larger and you can move the suitcase on the side like a book on a shelf. And that's a lot easier to get everybody's bags in.
Yeah, but I mean, there are many flights I've taken where my bag isn't, you know, it's several rows behind or in front because that's all that was available when I boarded the flight. So you just got to deal with that. It does make deplaning more complicated because you got people, you know, moving into other spaces. So it's not ideal, but I can understand that there's conflict over that. What are some of the other things that you deal with?
It's got to be the seats reclining. I tend to do a lot of the international from Phoenix to London and back. And, you know, people will put their seat backs. And when we're serving a meal, there's very little room on that tray table for their meal. So I'll ask the person in front of them, excuse me, can you put your seat up just while we're having our meal service so that they can use their tray? You know, 9 out of 10 times they'll say yes. Mm-hmm. But then just last week I got that one person who said, well, tell him in front of me to put his seat up too.
Oh gosh.
And so just like,
dealing with children. Yes. So how much training do you and your colleagues get in diffusing these situations and dealing with human psychology?
Well, every year we go through a recurrent training. It's basically for emergencies and our commands, but we do cover for an hour or so situations like that and how we handle them how we should. And we go over the tools because a lot of times you'll forget I have tools to help me with these situations. And one of the situations is if I'm having an issue with someone and they just are so angry, they're mad at me, I will have another flight attendant step in to handle it because now their anger's not, it's still directed at me, but now they have a new person to handle it. That's a big tool.
Yeah, just shake things up. Laura, thank you for being with us and spending overtime because we had so many terrific listener questions and comments about this. Really appreciate you being with us.
Thank you, Larry, very much.
Safe flying. Laura Ketterman, flight attendant for one of the big three airlines, co-host of the Airline Employee and Aviation Podcast, Non-Rev Lounge. And thank you all so much for your comments in this segment of Air Talk about some of the most heated confrontations aboard planes, particularly when people are asked to switch seats. Stay tuned. NPR's Here and Now comes up next on 89.3. At noon, it's Fresh Air with Tanya Mosley. And then at 1 o'clock, it's the first hour of NPR's All Things Considered. That's coming up with Sharon McNary filling in for Austin today at 1 o'clock. I'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 9, right after Morning Edition, for the next Air Talk here on LAist 89.3. So stay tuned. Have a great rest of your day.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.